From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, an opponent of mining up north takes on the conventional wisdom about jobs.
The real question of sustainable jobs and real projects that are going to enhance and infuse communities with a good life still needs to be addressed.
Others say experienced miners have been forced out of the region to find work.
It's tearing our family apart, and I feel that you should be listening to the Iron County residents, and 85% of them were for opening the mine.
Why some local people are bringing back the basketball court from the old Mecca Arena, and we'll chat with actor Sean Astin on the set of a movie being made in Milwaukee. Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Debate continues over a proposed iron ore mine in northern Wisconsin. The state legislature paved the way earlier this year for Gogebic Taconite to apply for permission to build the mine. Last week, the State Department of Natural Resources held a public hearing on the first exploratory step in the proposal. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz attended the hearing in the far northern town of Hurley. She reports the majority of the people at the hearing spoke against the proposed mine. One of the leading opponents chose not to attend. Mike Wiggins is chairman of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. Speaking from his office on the reservation, Wiggins refuted the argument that mining is the best solution for a job-starved region.
The real question of sustainable jobs and real projects that are going to enhance and infuse communities with a good life still needs to be addressed. Mining is a myth. It's a myth in terms of this whole notion that there's going to be manna from heaven for the surrounding communities. I'll tell you something. I've been to, I don't know how many hearings. We just had a great big hearing in Hurley yesterday. The mining company has all the money in the world, right? And they could easily grab a Greyhound bus, go over to Hibbing or one of these Iron Range towns, and get people on the bus to come testify that, listen, guys, you have to wake up and realize these mines are incredible. We're so better off now, and we're so wealthy, and our schools are flush, and this is wonderful. Don't fight this. And all these citizens from all these Iron Range towns could be coming to convince us of that. And where are they? There ain't a one. We are fighting the mine, and we are becoming more and more aware, and as a result, more and more empowered to, you know, protect, preserve, conserve what we got so that we can pass it on to future generations there. So,
do you have a strategy? At a given point, you'll take a certain measure?
Well, we have different litigation strategies going. You know, we're going to look at taking this to the courts on different levels. There will be
the federal court, obviously.
Well, federal court, and not to say the state court ain't available either. When you really look at the mining law from a public trust doctrine perspective, it is a complete obliteration of the public trust doctrine, and there are points of entry for litigation there that are being mulled over, and I'm sure they're being mulled over by other environmental groups. You know, as this moves along, the stakes are going to ratchet even higher, the emotions are going to ratchet even higher, and the need to hit those entry points for litigation are going to finally, you know, bubble up to the surface. When it comes to the true big picture, I see our watershed, again, 40% of the wetlands, internationally recognized, the headwaters, Class A, top-notch, you know, as good as you're going to find in the world. The entire watershed is a model that not only can be a place to visit and learn, but can actually become a classroom for the world in the future. I look at the UW system and its whole body of researchers and scientists and everything else, and those questions of natural ecosystems and how to reclaim some of these areas that have been devastated, countries like China, you know, those places they've devastated themselves. and done to themselves because of their lack of regulations. When the time comes to for those people to try and reclaim those areas or put some integrity and life back into those areas, they're going to need places like the Bad River Watershed to look to gather that data and to see what kinds of things are there that bring that quality of life for all, you know, all things. And here we have it. Combined with that UW system, I think, you know, you have an unbelievable opportunity to have a lab that is going to just grow in importance for the next few hundred years, you know. And all of that stuff is possible after we start punching holes in the layers of exclusivity and after we get ourselves past the 20-year timeline or the 25-year timeline of thinking that exploding the headwaters of the watershed is some path of wisdom for us and all of our children to come.
Mike Wiggins is the chairman of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. He spoke with Lake Effect Susan Bentz. As we mentioned earlier, the DNR held a public hearing on the proposed iron ore mine in Hurley last week. While most people at the hearing spoke against the proposal, a vocal minority spoke out in favor, including these three advocates.
My name is Rhonda Okunin. I live in Hurley. I'm coming on behalf of my family and many other families that are in the same situation that I am in. I grew up in this area with the mine in my backyard. My grandparents on both sides and my husband's grandparents came here for mining from Cornwall, England, on my mom's side. And they lived to be in their 90s. So I do believe that our area needs this. Currently, my husband's working in Iowa as a directional driller. In the winter, he has to work in North Dakota. And he's one of many family men that are living this way. It's tearing our family apart, and I feel that you should be listening to the Iron County residents. And 85% of them were for opening the mine. So I would like to bring our family back together, and I would hope that you would help that.
My name's Paul Grabovsich, lifetime resident of Ironwood. And a little bit of background on me is my dad used to have the bus line running back and forth to the White Pine Mine. There was people from all the way from the Copper Country, Iron River, Watersmeet, Odena, High Bridge, Wisconsin, even as far as Bayfield, that worked that mine. Right now, our present condition, economic condition in this area is there is no new car dealership in this area. We have to go 40 miles to get a new car. When I graduated in 78, between us and the Catholic school, there was about 220 students. Now, they're down to about 80. That's what White Pine meant in our area. That's what White Pine meant. That was the biggest employer in the area. The thing is, the pro-mining side says this, the anti-mining side says that. How do they know? How do any one of these sites know without going ahead of the process? And they do mining in Upper Michigan, and they do mining in Minnesota, the open pit. Has anybody ever taken say, hey, these are the rules for Michigan, these are the rules for Minnesota. Let's follow these. Bang, 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 bang. Page per page. Has anybody ever proposed that or say, let's do that? Because the rules are there, and you know how they work. They're doing a fine job. People here are sick and tired of these $8 to $9 an hour jobs. They're existing, barely existing. There's the breakdown of the family, if there is even a family there together. There's no benefits, there's nothing. But when White Pine was here, these are the people that had the good families. They worked together. They were very good for the community. They were the ones that went to the store. They were the ones that went out to eat. They were the ones that put people to work in the area. Thank you very much.
I'm asking today that the bulk sampling application from Gogebic Taconite be approved. It's met all the criteria of Wisconsin statutes. The bulk sampling process is an important step in gathering data about the possibility of mining here in Iron County. This information will be one part of the exploratory phase. When put all together, will give us the science about mining instead of the vast amount of speculation that so many are currently engaged in.
Kelly Klein speaking at a DNR hearing in Hurley last week. Klein leads the Iron County Development Zone Council. He spoke at length with WUWM's Susan Bentz earlier this year about why he is so convinced that the mine would be a positive for the region.
Well, our organization sees a mine project as a very good economic development project. Obviously, there are a good number of jobs associated with it, not only regionally here, but there's a good number of jobs associated with it statewide. And that's our role, to try and create jobs and increase investments in the community.
Is there any kind of assurance that X number, X percent of these jobs will likely go to people who live there?
No. That conversation really hasn't taken place. There have been some steps made by the community colleges and the technical schools to increase programming so people could be trained for a potential mine. That has started to take place. But the process isn't far enough along to have any type of an agreement where a certain percentage needs to be hired from a certain area. That just hasn't gotten that far yet.
When would you expect that to click in so that people in Iron County, Ashland County, closest to the mine, could start preparing for the jobs that the mine could mean to that region?
Well, I think area residents, you know, in their own minds have probably prepared themselves a little bit. We've also drawn on experience from a copper mine in Michigan, in White Pine, Michigan, which is 50 or so miles from here, but a lot of people from here had worked there. So there is experience on from that end.
So would that be heavy equipment jobs, or what would that experience bring those residents to this new mining project?
I think that would be part of it. Also part of it, you know, technology has certainly changed things over the years. You need to be proficient with computers in all phases of mining, whether it's in a piece of equipment or in a processing plant or even out in the field, you know. Computers certainly play a role in that.
We do now have a Senate bill which will go to hearing this week, actually. Are any people from your organization going to travel down to Madison for that hearing?
Yeah, there will be several from the area.
Are you confident this is a bill that would bring the jobs and provide the structure that a mining bill should include? Have you taken a look at it?
Yeah, you know, we've got a copy of the bill. We've also read the Legislative Council's analysis of it. We're not alarmed by anything in it. I don't think, you know, several places in Ledge Council's analysis talks about the metrics stay the same. Some of the processes do change in this particular bill, but when you talk about measuring water quality or air quality, those metrics stay the same. And we're happy to see that. We don't want to ruin anything here, but yet we want to make the business climate friendly to the industry.
Have there been conversations that you've been a part of, both within the context of your job, but also in talking to people in the area, concerned about that balance of maintaining the quality of air and water, and at the same time providing jobs that are very much sought after? Is that a heavy discussion, or are you way past that conversation?
Well, this area was built around mining, you know, starting back in the 1800s. There hasn't been an iron ore mine here for about 50 years or so. But there was very active mining that built our towns, our communities. And there are many people in the area who either their families were involved or they were involved in the mines in those years. And really, they look around today and they say, we didn't ruin anything, and we weren't even regulated back then. So, you know, they're questioning, the community in large questions, why are we, you know, so concerned here? Today we have very strict regulations, And yet, when we mined before, we certainly didn't ruin anything. So that's kind of a thought process that's gone on here.
Any conversation that this is moving really fast from seeing this bill last week and then a hearing this week, not having a hearing in northern Wisconsin?
We've had difficulties trying to find a venue in past hearings up here. Our school can handle it, but then we have to close school down. As far as hearings in general, this issue has had a lot. You know, last year, this year, the year before, it's been vetted quite a bit. I don't have a problem with a hearing being scheduled already this week.
Mm-hmm. And it not being in northern Wisconsin.
Well, sure would be nice if we didn't have to travel, but I understand it's hard to find a place to do that.
Kelly, you live in an area where opinions do vary on the subject of whether mining should occur in the Pinokies or not. Would that be a fair statement? People saying, oh, please don't, it's going to impair waterways and wetlands, etc.
You know, I don't hear much of that in Iron County. Other areas may be a little different, but mm-hmm. I think Iron County, again, they've experienced this before. They've seen their families go through this before, and nothing ever got ruined. They're not overly concerned.
What have you seen transpire in Iron County over your life there? And
well, you know, I've observed over the years a decline in population. For example, the last census, just in the last 10 years, the county's population dropped by 14%. That's tough to deal with because when you lose population, you lose a customer base for your businesses. And that means maybe a loss of business services. So we'd like to, you know, I really think we could stabilize that whole scenario if, you know, with a project like this, whether it's a hardware store or whether it's a restaurant or a gas station. I would think with more income potential in the area, you know, that would certainly help stabilize, if not to grow our business services.
What else do you have in the works in Iron County looking for other avenues for jobs? Is there something else on the front burner?
Well, this has consumed quite a bit of our time recently.
Yeah, I'm sure it does.
We do also, our office also works closely with the Hurley and the Mercer Chambers of Commerce. And tourism is certainly an important industry to our area. And so we collaborate with the two chambers of commerce and do some joint tourism marketing for winter and summer. So that's always something we're working on and trying to get better at.
Kelly Klein leads the Iron County Development Zone Council. He spoke with Susan Bentz in January. You can find more coverage of the proposed iron ore mine at WUWM.com. We're going to take a break now, but when we return, the effort to bring back an iconic Milwaukee basketball court as an art piece. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. If you are more than 35 years old and you grew up watching sports in Milwaukee, you probably have memories of an iconic basketball court. The playing surface at the arena called Mecca, now the U.S. Cellular Arena, did not look like other basketball courts. It was a surface designed and painted by Robert Indiana. He's the artist who designed the famous Love postage stamp. It was played on by the Bucks and the Marquette University basketball team until both moved to the Bradley Center in the 1980s. The court disappeared from public view, but tonight it returns for a single night's appearance at the U.S. Cellular Arena. The owners of the court, who call themselves Our Mecca Group, plan to turn the court into an evolving art exhibit. Andy Gorzalski and Ben Kohler are in the studio now to talk about what that means and how tonight's event came together. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you.
What makes this more than just another former basketball court?
It's the world's largest pop art painting created by a world-renowned artist, Robert Indiana, of the love generation, you could say. Robert Indiana was one of the pioneers of the pop movement with Warhol and Lichtenstein. And we, in 1977, had an opportunity to convince him to come to Milwaukee and design our basketball court that became his largest piece of art and also became the largest pop art painting in the world still to this day.
Well, and for people who haven't seen this, and we're going to put a picture of it up on our website, but how does it look different than the basketball courts that came before or really the basketball courts that are around now?
Basketball courts back then and to a large degree now are very utilitarian. You know, you just have the sort of boundaries and the more technical parts of the game of basketball represented in just very clean lines, you know, very simple, spare design. So even more so back then, it was at best sometimes just a colored lane that represented a team's colors and not much else. They weren't even putting, you know, Cleveland or Buffalo on the baseline. It was just a very spare stage for the game.
Well, and really, basketball courts, you know, they have to have the foul lines. They have to have the center circle. But there's not much more that they really have to have. Describe this for us. What does it look like?
Oh, the Mecca floor?
Yeah.
Well, the Mecca floor, what's interesting about that is they chose Robert as the artist because he had very geometrical shapes in his art. And he was very symbolic with numbers and letters. So they felt that he was the type of artist that actually could get a basketball floor right. So the Mecca floor has six M's in its design. They say it's good in the words of Robert Indiana. But what's interesting about that is the M letter is actually Robert's favorite letter. And it's one of his favorite symbols because he looks at letters as symbols. So there's six M's in the design. Those six M's are significant and symbolic. They stand for Milwaukee, Mecca, the Milwaukee Bucks, Marquette, Steve Marcus, whose idea it was to make the Mecca floor. And since Robert's art was inspired by his mom, every athlete has a mom. So you'll see very predominant six M's in the court, and it takes on the colors of the home teams, which was green and red at the time, the Bucks, and blue and gold of the Marquette Warriors. And then also there's orange hues there because they wanted to allow the athletes to be able to have an easy transition from maple flooring to an all-painted surface, because if you're not familiar with the Mecca floor, it is the only all-painted professional sports floor in existence. So when they made the design, they wanted the transition to be easier on the players. I mean, Robert at first, he wanted a purple floor, but that didn't quite happen. So they compromised and they found a way to transition the players to something that wouldn't shock them totally.
Did it do something to put Milwaukee on the basketball map? I mean, was there something, I mean, aside from it being iconic for the people that came to games or played on the floor, this is a floor that people knew around the country, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, sort of at the dawn of the floor was the beginning of the Don Nelson era and the tail end of the Al McGuire era transitioning into Hank Raymond's for Marquette basketball. So the Bucks reemerged very quickly after the Kareem and Oscar Robertson era, and they ended up winning around 75% of their games on this floor. So it was a good omen of good times and winning and kind of a golden era of Bucks and Marquette basketball from 77 to 88.
Well, and so how did the two of you enter the picture, and maybe why did the two of you enter the picture?
I guess
part one of the story.
Yes. Well, the first step all starts with an email. I receive an email from my friend. It's a link to an architectural salvage site. Everyone knows I'm a huge Bucks fan, so he jokingly says, "Hey, you can buy the Bucks floor now and put it in your backyard and shoot around." So I click on his little joke, and lo and behold, it's Robert Indiana's Mecca floor on this listing. And it was sort of sad to me in a lot of ways because it just said, "Use gym floor." In the listing. No one knew that they had this beautiful piece of fine art in Milwaukee history. So I
had the Bucks just gotten rid of it?
Well, the Bucks moved across the street to the Bradley Center in 1988, and the Mecca Complex in the Wisconsin Center District kept it for a small handful of years, and then it kind of bounced around to different holding warehouses in their facility. It was eventually donated to a charter school that didn't quite make it, unfortunately, and then it was just taking up space in someone's warehouse, and it it, you know, it's a problem into it of itself. So it was just taking up space. Whoever ran the warehouse at that time said, let's get this thing out of here, just sell it.
Can I ask how much was it selling for at the time?
We always like to say for, you know, a couple of regular guys, a scary amount. Scary enough to like the conversation with my wife was fairly serious that day. So an amount enough to rattle your nerves that day.
Like they like are you spending that much on a car? I mean, like ballpark?
Yeah, somewhere in that ballpark for sure. A really nice car.
Well, so why – you're a big Bucks fan, but why you? Why is this such – was this such an important thing to you that you know, that this all had to happen?
Well, you know, in talking about this project, one of the people we talked to was kind of an auctioneer memorabilia person. They were actually auctioning off the Dallas Mavericks 2011 championship floor. And one of the things he talked about was – people will sometimes hang on to sports memorabilia as a symbol of their memories, and especially like the time with their fathers. We're always trying to wind back and get to that emotional place. So sports memorabilia, the players, the places where we had those experiences become emotionally important to us. So for me, being a Milwaukee kid in the 80s, I mean, the Bucks were my Beatles. They were always winning. Going to the Mecca Arena was a hard ticket. It was very special when you got to go to one of them. So even as a child, I sort of warmly remember sort of the golden glow of the floor, and it was very dark and dingy in there. And the, you know, we had great teams and these epic battles. So there was a premium on what I recall from my life.
Well, and Ben, what's part two of the story?
Well, part two is, you know, Andy, you know, goes on a limb, takes out a personal line of credit, and convinces his wife somehow to allow him to do this. And in the process of like basically rescuing the floor, he sends out an email to some of his connections at the Milwaukee Bucks. And it was really interesting email because it had a whole lot of exclamation points in it. I remember I was looking at it last night and I was like, wow, he really put some exclamation in this thing.
Maybe not my best foot forward. Yeah.
But you could tell that there was this passion behind it, and there was this guy that was really, really passionate about it. And this email ended up being forwarded to Jim Paschke, who forwarded it to John Steinmiller, vice president of operations, who forwarded it to my father, Greg. And at the time, Greg had an athletic surfacing company, ProStar Incorporated, been in business for 35 years doing gym floors. And my dad, you know, built a company out of our basement in the inner city of Milwaukee and built it into a really, you know, well-known, nice-sized company that had over 25 employees and, you know, a couple million dollars a year in business. And so the Bucks were one of my dad's clients, and they said, hey, Greg, there's, you know, kind of a just a small conflict of interest. We would prefer not to reach out directly. Can you check on this thing for us? And I think they sent that with having no idea that my dad would actually be remotely interested or even have the capability to purchase this floor. And I remember we were in a meeting with the Boys and Girls Club director, Sam Williams, who actually played on the Mecca floor. And my dad literally just stood up in the middle of a meeting, in the middle of a conversation, and said, guys, I have to leave because I have to go see about a floor. And it was like that, the basketball version of Goodwill Hunting. You know, it's like, all right, well, and then all of a sudden he comes back and he says, you know, I just bought the Mecca floor. And I was living in L.A. at the time, and I had no real idea of what the Mecca floor was or what it represented or the backstory of it. I was an avid Bucks fan growing up. My dad was in the gym floor business, so, you know, and the Bucks were one of his clients, and he was a season ticket holder for 25 years. So I spent a lot of time watching the Bucks, but my era was in the Bradley Center. And so I remember asking my dad, I said, well, what are you going to do with this thing? I mean, you buy this floor during one of the most turbulent times of your company's financial history. You almost give my mom a heart attack because she's trying to figure out, you know, we're a family-run business, so how are we going to make payroll? And my dad, he had that like that kid that just got the bike at Christmas smile, and he looks at me and he says, you know, I have no idea what I'm going to do with this floor, but I have a vision. And he said, I want to celebrate the history of Milwaukee's innovation and Milwaukee's risk-taking and Milwaukee's our spirit of like being different. And I didn't really understand that because I didn't know what the story was at the time. And he said, I also want to take that celebration of this history that we have and also use it to inspire future generations. And, you know, it was very altruistic at the time, and I was living in L.A., and I said, well, Dad, that sounds like a great vision. See you when I see you, because I'm getting on a plane tomorrow and I'm going to back to L.A., so good luck with that. Fast forward a year later, I'm back in town to help my dad's company that's still in dire straits, and, you know, it was a very, very difficult time. And my dad, we had a meeting with a local artist, Reginald Baylor, and some people from the community to talk about how we could display the Mecca floor as a work of art and as this beacon of light in our city. And at that meeting, my dad basically nominated me forcefully to lead this project. Well, 4 days later, my dad died of a massive heart attack, totally out of the blue, totally unexpectedly, and just basically threw my life in this tailspin of like trying to figure out what to do with this company. And one thing led to another, and I knew that he had this vision for the Mecca floor, and I decided to purchase it from his company before the, you know, the walls caved in.
Well, and so how has your vision for the floor evolved? What's going to happen to it?
Okay, so I ended up meeting a guy named Jeremy Shamrovich from Flux Design, who's probably one of the most creative people I've ever had the chance to be in person with, next to like a Robert Indiana or even Reggie Baylor. But Jeremy's is really – what I like about Jeremy and Flux Design and why I reached out to them is, for one, they're Milwaukee guys. So they're very, very adamant about Milwaukee and the city. And also they're problem solvers. So we had this problem. Nobody could figure out what to do with a 7,000-square-foot piece of pop art. I mean, you have to have a really big wall, a really big ceiling, a really big combination of a wall or ceiling if you're thinking about in the general scheme of how do you display a painting. And Jeremy right away said we're looking at it all wrong. It's not a floor. It is the world's largest pop art painting that comes in 264x8 sections. Let's build something with it. And I said, that sounds like a very intriguing idea. As long as that we can preserve the art and it can always go back to being a basketball floor, let's look into that. So we spent an entire year researching, developing, and designing what we now call the Mecca Sculpture, which is an interactive and interchangeable modular sculpture system that allows us to put the Mecca floor that is now the sculpture in different places. We can change the shape, and also it's an exhibit in the sense that we can tell a story, because the Mecca, to anybody that's listening right now, I think it's an intriguing story about Milwaukee, about creativity, about risk-taking, about innovation, about community coming together. So I knew that when we created this sculpture, displayed this art, that I always wanted to have an exhibit that would be able to tell a narrative and draw a person in. So you know, Friday night is the night that we actually get to go forward with my dad's first part of the vision, which was to celebrate the history. So we're putting the Mecca floor in the Mecca arena where it was created for, laying it out like a basketball floor and saying, look what we did. Let's celebrate that. Let's bring the players together, the Steve Marcuses, the John Steinmillers, the Bob Laniers, the different people, the Robert Indianas. Let's bring these people together that created this thing and honor it. And then September 20th is when we're doing our first sculptural exhibit at City Hall, which will be a very dynamic visual that will pose a very interesting question. Let's just say that. I think if anybody remembers this interview, when they see it in September 20th, they'll say, now it makes sense why you made that statement. So giving you guys a little hint right there.
Well, and is the idea when you start doing these things with it to take basketball out of the equation?
Oh, absolutely not. And I think Andy can speak to that.
Yeah, I think this is basically a sports story that takes place in the art world. So the sport and basketball component to this is definitely a part of that overall narrative. It's part of Milwaukee history and our sports history, as well as a symbol of thinking big creatively and helping to make us a creative place that we're in now.
Well, and so do you have plans for it after the September exhibit at City Hall?
Yes. So basically what's going to happen is the Mecca sculpture, which is a smaller version of the large sculpture, which the large sculpture takes all 260 pieces. So we're going to take, for this City Hall exhibit, we're going to take 40 pieces. We're going to put it into a really interesting shape, curate an exhibit specifically for City Hall, which is part of what we call the new Mecca acronym, which stands for Milwaukee Entertainment, Creativity, Commerce, and Athletics. So we pick 5 places all around Milwaukee that were kind of tied to those different areas and audiences. So the Milwaukee themed exhibit is going to be the City Hall, and it will tell the story of what we're talking about now, how the Mecca floor came about and its significance for the city. Following that, we're going to be going to the Bradley Center, for the kickoff of Bucks and Marquette season. So then it's, again, tying in the athletics with the art. And then from there, we were looking to go to the convention center. And then the two spots that are going to be the remaining spots, we're in the process of kind of working out those deals. So we really can't talk about those. But so, you know, September, City Hall, end of October, you know, Bradley Center, and then we'll be moving to the convention center. And then after that year, we'll be going around the nation. So we have a couple spots that we're considering right now and a couple places that we're beginning those conversations. So the hope is to let Milwaukee see what we created, we as a community, for a year, and then put it on tour for a year or two in hopes and with the intention that in that time frame, we as a community and as a city realize what we have with the Milwaukee Bucks, and we can build an arena that's not just for athletics, but also in an arena that can integrate art and creativity and entertainment and community aspects, so that we could have this complex. And I think that around that time is when we'll begin the discussions of bringing the Mecca Floor home and potentially, you know, hopefully working with the architects and the design teams that are building the arena to actually build some sort of wing or some sort of wall or some sort of something where the Mecca Floor can be there. And that's the intention for the end game. The end game is kind of far away, but we do know that at some point the Mecca Floor needs to be in the next athletic facility that is used for both, you know, Marquette and Bucks sports, as well as something, you know, that's a creative place to be too. So it's exciting to think about that one day, you know, in 2017, I might be able to walk into the arena with my partner and look up on a wall and see the Mecca Floor and say, wow, look at the journey that we just took from 2010 from an email. As a joke email to, you know, 7 years later, looking at the world's largest pop art painting in this incredible new arena with a really great NBA team and a big community boost behind it. So when I go to sleep at night and I dream, that's what I dream, is that someday, you know, my children and my children's children can go to games and look at that piece and say, hey, a group of really inspired people saved it, recreated it, and then brought it back to what it was. And I think that that's the interesting part of the story, is that it's not changing, but it is changing. And it's kind of like your community, right? Your community kind of keeps that ethos or that idea of itself, but the world is always revolving and progressing. And I think that that's the reason why we decided, besides spacing issues for the sculpture, but we wanted to say, hey, let's take a different look at this. Let's ask or pose ourselves different questions of why art is important, why sports are important. I mean, those are the two most cut things in our education system right now, and those are the two things that we're waving the flags for with this exhibit. And underlining as a altruistic motivation for me is to continue to wave those flags for the importance of art and athletics in our youth and in our community and in our city. So it's exciting to think about that we could actually be part of that dialogue.
It is it's a very exciting story. And thanks to both of you for sharing it with us, and best of luck.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. We hope to see you all in Milwaukee out tonight.
Yep.
Ben Kohler and Andy Gorzalski formed Our Mecca Group, which is putting the basketball court from the U.S. Cellular Arena, formerly called Mecca, on display tonight at the arena. The art exhibit that uses parts of the court will open at Milwaukee City Hall September 20th. You can find a link to more, plus more of our conversation, at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. One last break, and then we'll talk with actor Sean Astin. He stars in a movie wrapping up filming in Milwaukee today. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. People along Milwaukee's lakefront on Wednesday saw what they might have believed was a Coast Guard helicopter water rescue going on off McKinley Marina. It might have seemed confusing, though, since the rescue appeared to take place at least three times. What was actually going on was the making of a feature film. Principal photography wraps up today in Milwaukee for The Surface. It's a drama about two troubled men who are thrown together by circumstances in the middle of Lake Michigan. We spoke earlier this summer with a writer and director of The Surface. That was Jeff Gendelman and Gil Cates Jr. But this week, we had a chance to catch up with the film's star. Sean Astin is best known for his lead roles in The Lord of the Rings and Rudy. In The Surface, he plays a character named Mitch, and Sean Astin picks up the story from there.
I'm playing the character of Mitch, a despondent soul who has had a lot of really hard luck and loss in his life. And at the beginning of the movie, he's going to commit suicide. The premise of the film is that he, as he goes out on his idea of how to do it, is to go out in the middle of Lake Michigan. And when he gets out there, he runs over some debris of a plane, a single-engine plane that's crashed. And the pilot of that plane is injured badly and is holding on to the floating pontoon from the plane. And Mitch, his name is Kelly, played by Chris Mulkey. So Mitch pulls Kelly into the boat. And when he ran over the debris, the prop was knocked off the back of this old 1970s-era ski boat. So they're just dead in the water, these two guys, one who's injured, one who's despondent. It's a story, a kind of redemptive story about meaning in life.
And it is a really compelling sounding story. Why did it work so well for you? Why did you want to be a part of this film?
As an actor, you look for opportunities, you know, and I've done lately some kind of horror movies and some family comedies, and I've done some slapsticky kind of stuff. And when this one came across my desk, it seemed like a really good opportunity to work as an actor in a dramatic space and in a space where your emotions are engaged, your, you know, thoughts, ideas about life and death, you know, mortality and man's search for meaning in this world. You know, I mean, those all sound like highfalutin concepts, but embedded in what we're doing is that stuff, and that's what I, and you know, I also, the challenge of making a movie on the water and knowing that it would be out there is sort of alluring, if you will.
Well, and you describe Mitch as this despondent soul who's really in trouble. After shooting on the water, do you feel like you have more insight into that mentality?
Well, like a lot of people, I've been touched by suicide in my personal life and with family, and so the nature of that emotional, the gravity of that kind of pain is something that I'm familiar with. I think being out on the water filming, I don't know, there's something about the natural elements that really awakens something inside of you. And it's interesting that he's looking to die in that space, and the water can be very, very deadly. You know, it's almost like a desert. You know, it's a wet desert sometimes if you're far enough out there. And yet, to me, it's vivifying. The spray of the water, the way the sun hits you off the surface all day long, you know, and gives you a little bit of a windburn, sunburn every day. And to me, it's very, very inspiring, actually. So, yeah.
Well, and let me ask you this, because you know, you could be shooting water scenes on a soundstage in a much more controlled environment. It's kind of hard to predict how things will work. I'm sure the crew of this movie has done everything it can to control the environment to allow you to best perform. But has it been a challenge to be in some place that you really, you know, as a creative person, can't control, like Lake Michigan?
Oh, it's been hard as hell. I mean, you've got a number of people who are very skilled, very trained in their area of expertise, and they all have to work together in an area that is not sort of, that doesn't lend itself. You know, guys who are good with grip equipment aren't necessarily guys who understand sales. In this particular case, there are guys who do know a lot about each other's kind of domain, but the wind changes, the waves pick up, boats kind of move this way or that way. I think audiences now come to expect a certain level of realism with stuff they watch. So when you're making a little independent film, unless you're, you know, in a one tiny little setting and it's very controlled, you want to sense the expanse, the vastness of the horizon. And there's only one way to really do that. So Jeff has marshaled a lot of different resources. It's a little independent film. He's got a reputation in this community and lots of friends, and he's able to deploy different, you know, boats and technology and stuff. But when it all gets right down to it, at a certain point, once you're out on the water, there's a certain amount of people, there's a certain amount of equipment, and, you know, nature does its thing. So but that's why everybody was in for it. Everybody's into it and up for it. But it is absolutely challenging and sometimes really, really frustrating.
Well, I was going to ask, it must be frustrating when you're in a moment and everything is going right, and the second you go to do something, the wind shifts or the boat rocks or something else that you can't do
anything. The hardest thing for us has been anchoring the boats. We've been filming off of any one of three or four different boats, and it takes a while for the skipper to decide on how far away from the breakwater you're going to be, on, you know, what direction it's going to, you know, and what's on the bottom. Is it going to drag along the silt? Are you going to find a big shipwreck? Literally, you know, like, oh, we better not anchor here. We'll lose the anchor on that 1950s whatever ship that they sank out there and they're making a reef out of, you know. So waiting for that to happen required the most amount of patience, you know. And everybody feels it at the same time. There have been times where the boats are in position, the picture boat that's meant to be sinking, so they put water in it, which means you can't move it quickly. You know, that the relationship of those boats to each other, it takes time to get that set up. And the swells start picking up, and, you know, everybody's on the boats, everybody wants to be safe. And so you sort of think, okay, you know, you go out to golf, it starts lightning, you got to wait in the clubhouse.
You used the term vivifying earlier. You're just a few short days away from wrapping filming on this. Is there a certain amount of energizing that, I mean, are you still as energized on this day of filming as you were when things got going?
Well, two things. One, it's not that long of a shoot. I mean, because it's a lower budget production, they're trying to do really big things in a really small amount of time. So, I mean, I'm away from my family, so it feels like a long time to me. But you're asking me the question on, yes, it's at the end. Today was Coast Guard Day. Today we had the Coast Guard helicopter flying overhead and the swimmer jumping in, and we got, you know, Mulkey goes up and down in the basket twice, and at the end I got to go up in the basket, and the yacht was there, and you're filming essentially the rescue of the movie, which is the... I give a little thing with the crew today where I just said, look, our purpose of making this movie is to help people. You know, Jeff talks about it and I talk about it, that like if somebody's considering suicide, maybe on some levels they can see this movie. It's not too hard for me to believe that I'll hear somebody in a year saying, my God, my brother was feeling really low and I showed him this movie and it really meant something to him. So movies actually have the capacity to impact people in their decision making, in their life. So idea, whether it actually happens or not, that's our idea going into it. Well, that's the Coast Guard's mission too. So the elan, the spirit of what we're doing completely syncs up with their mission of rescuing people and healing people and saving them, you know. So today is a day where all things have coalesced in the most logistically precise and rigorous manifestation, but also the most exciting, the most fun, the most rewarding.
I know acting is all about being a human on camera or on stage or in whatever venue.
I try.
Well, and when you're in a basket getting hoisted into a helicopter, what does that feel like as a human being?
Well, Chris Mulkey, you ask me as an actor, so from a performance standpoint, really, he's knocked out as he's going up there, and I wasn't on camera doing it, so it doesn't matter. but as a human being, to be pulled up in that, and you know, I'm one of these guys who kind of thinks that things carry the energy of their intention. So if you pick up a gun, you know, that gun carries energy. If you picture you pick up a scalpel that was used in a brain surgery, that means something. So you get in that basket and you know, as you're gripping your hands on the side of that basket was used to really help somebody who was really in a moment of drama and danger in their life. And so with the rotor wash above you, which they say at a certain place under and behind it, it's like near hurricane force winds. You have to close your eyes and squint into it as it's blasting you in the face, and that wakes you up. The water was cold, so you're awake from that. And as you get lifted out of the air, it just becomes this, you just get, it's ebullient. And then all of a sudden, everything that was so chaotic, it becomes serene. And the sound of the rotors become almost like you're going into a womb, and it's this nice, you know, maternal hum that takes you into it, and it's just flat out fun. I mean, you know, the human beings have the technology that we've arrived at in 2013 is extraordinary, and the training of the Coast Guard is really, 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 really special. These guys and gals, so today it was guys, are physically fit, they're mentally sharp, and yet they have a great sense of humor. I can't say enough about what a great experience we had with the Coast Guard and how much we appreciate their letting us have a bigger production value because they're willing to come out and play with us for a day.
Any last thoughts on just the whole experience on working on this movie versus everything? I mean, you've worked on some obviously much larger budget films than this.
The budget stuff doesn't matter. If you're standing against a green screen, you're standing on a volcano or whatever, the words are your words, your emotions are your emotions, and sure, things are, you know, it's relative and it's different, but I would say conceptually that Lake Michigan, the Great Lakes as an idea, and Lake Michigan, I think are largely kind of beyond the attention of most Americans. And so, I mean, certainly not the people who live in Wisconsin and, you know, Illinois and the people that are right along it, but you get down in New Mexico and whatever. I don't know how much people give a crud about the Great Lakes. The fact is that we have these vast, massive, ocean-sized freshwater repositories, and protecting them, understanding them, caring about them, respecting their, you know, what they are, is something that in an age where this planet is enduring a lot of trauma, like, we've got these amazing, we've got this, it's very special. It's very, very special. Our military has a history on this lake. The pollution, the life of the pollution in the lake has its own history that's probably useful for people to know in the next 100 years. And from a spiritual, from a dramatic, from a philosophical point of view, I really am proud to have communed with Lake Michigan, to have engaged it from Milwaukee, from Wisconsin, and to have sort of created something that you can put in a time capsule from this moment. And I hope that people don't dismiss right away, that they take an extra second and they'll go, oh, Lake Michigan. Give it the weight that it deserves when you say it and you hear it. And maybe you'll be curious to check out our little movie.
Sean Astin, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Actor Sean Astin speaking with me at McKinley Marina on the set of The Surface, a movie wrapping up filming in Milwaukee today. Astin plays the lead character named Mitch in the production. He's also known for his roles as Samwise Gamgee in the Lord of the Rings movies and as the title character in Rudy. You'll find a link to our July interview with the movie's writer and producer and director, that's Jeff Gendelman and Gil Cates Jr., from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. Thanks so much for listening to Friday's edition of Lake Effect. From all of us, including producers Bonnie North, Dan Harmon, Stephanie Lecce, and Amy Kiley, and our team of interns, including Eleanor Peterson, Rachel Bloom, and Nathan Royster. And we especially want to thank Gabby Magallanes, who leaves us this week after a fantastic summer stint with us. We're so sorry to see her go, but wish her the best for the upcoming school year, and we are hopeful she will be back on the weekly roll of the credits next summer. I'm Mitch Teich. I sure hope you can be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned because Fresh Air is coming your way next. It's 11 o'clock.